It's my pleasure to introduce Angelos Mangionis, who is going to talk about kidney stones this morning. Dr. Mangionis studied undergraduate work at Gettysburg College, and then he did his medicine at the University of Maryland and did his urology residency at Penn. He's been on staff at Boca Regional Hospital for over 17 years and has served as chief of the Department of Surgery. This morning, he's going to tell us all we ever want to know about kidney stones.
Thank you. I would like to thank everybody for coming this morning. Hopefully, this won't be too painful, right? kidney stones. Got some disclosures first. Obviously, I've been on staff here for quite some time. I'm in group practice locally. I'm a volunteer assistant professor at FAU and FIU. Shameless plug, there is a rotation in urology. You're welcome to sign up if you so desire. This is for the medical students here. And I have no commercial affiliation to disclose. Before I start, I would like to just give you a little personal story about kidney stones. I mean, probably part of the reason I'm here in this particular location. I was at Penn doing clinic rotation, and as most programs at the time was very heavy on surgery volume, but for whatever reason, I decided I need to rotate through the clinic. Was an elderly doctor just came over from the University of Arizona that was just doing clinic, and he asked me, Angelos, how do you manage medically your kidney stone patients? And I made the mistake of saying I refer him to nephrology. He did not like that. He's like, come to my office later on. Later on, turns out, and he went over, you know, how to manage. We're going to talk some of those concepts today. Turns out his name was Dr. George Drock. He was the chairman at the University of Arizona, trained Jeff Miller. That's the reason I'm here. And he wrote the main chapter at the time for medical management of kidney stones at Campbell's Urology. So he showed me. But anyway, so I took an interest in managing medically the kidney stones, and we'll talk mainly about that. We'll touch upon surgery, but obviously that's if you decide to go into urology residency. Epidemiology, I already found out from our audience here, it's quite common. I mean, it's 8.8% of the populations, depending which study you look at, 1 to 15% of people in this country at some point in their life will be affected with kidney stones. And this is symptomatic stones, not asymptomatic. That's more common. So obviously a common condition. The peak incidence is a little bit younger in men, 30 to 69, that's the peak incidence. It does happen in younger patients. Of course, it happens in older, but that's when it peaks. Women tend to be a little bit later in the game with kidney stones. It's felt it's due to the protective effect of estrogen because it does induce a state of increased urinary citrate and low calcium, and also the fact that after menopause, women are more prone to urinary tract infections, which, as we'll find out later, it is a leading contributor to stone formation. So the incidence has doubled and continues to increase lately. I mean, I think a lot of them have to do with increased detection. We use CTs now, which we didn't 40 years ago, but also some lifestyle issues we're going to touch upon later. It's an expensive expenditure. These are old numbers from 10 years ago. I'm sure it's even higher now. $1 billion, it's an inpatient management. This is just direct stone cost, not obviously loss of work and things like that, and of course a lot of pain involved. Historically, men were thought to be 2 to 3 times more common. That disparity is closing. Now it's about 1.5. I think there are certain lifestyle issues with women that making it more and more common as we go on. More common in white people, but also Hispanics, equivalent of 70% of the whites, Asians, and African Americans. The interesting with African Americans, women are more common to get stones than men, which is the only population. And again, may have to do with the effects we're going to talk about later. So the geography, the obvious, I mean, hot, arid, dry climates, tropical, basically here, desert like Nevada, Arizona, mountain, Utah, places like that. There's this prevalent stones in the south, southeast, basically Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, stone belt. We have to probably due to the heat, but also some dietary factors. Peak incidence, these are studies mainly up in the northeast and also around the country, around the world in Taiwan, for example. They found out that stones come after the hottest part of the year, which is the summer, of course. So peak incidence between July and September. So if you're working in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, you're usually going to see most of your stone patients September through November. They just kind of, but obviously here in Florida, we see them year round. And we do have, we have some urologists in the crowd. They know we have a lot of patients that are snowbirds. I never had a stone in New York or Boston. They come down here to start forming stones because they're on the golf course all day long, and that's what happens in Florida. So obviously it's more common in workers in hot environments. That makes a lot of sense, but what may not make sense right away is it is more common in sedentary professionals. Kidney stones is a disease of the first world, so to speak. I mean, they're not very common in, you know, developing countries, but they're increasingly common in, you know, our country and other first world type countries. So this is the issue, I think, that is more common in sedentary professionals and other, in general, Americans, I guess. It's these are pretty solid studies. There's a direct correlation between the weight of an individual and the likelihood they're going to form stones. That seems to cap out when the BMI reaches about 30%, which is quite high. At that point, it kind of plateaus. And that correlation is more significant in women. The concept of metabolic syndrome, which is basically a combination of obesity, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, hyperglycemia for the urologists in the crowd, also low testosterone, that is part of, in the men, that's also part of metabolic syndrome. That has been, in some studies, shown to be associated with kidney stones, up with tripling the incidence from the baseline population. So, and of course, another condition which is very common is type 2 diabetes, you know. That also has been shown to increase the incidence of stones. Now, the way these conditions, and again, metabolic syndromes, obesity, type 2 diabetes, are basically in the same kind of arena, they have effects of the pH. They tend to have more acidic urine, increased urinary calcium, and decreased citrate, which will lead to stone formation. So these are all the different stone types. Don't focus too much on these because actually 90-95% of the percent of the stones are a mixture of all these. There's always a calcium component, so I always love when patients said, well, what type of stone do I have? And, you know, I'll tell them, well, it's calcium oxalate. I mean, how do I know that? Because 70-80% of them are predominantly calcium oxalate. So if you're playing the, you know, the luck game, that's probably what they're going to have. But there's different types of calcium. I mean, the two most common types are the first two, calcium oxide mono and dihydrate. I mean, that whether they have one or two water molecules, tricalcium phosphate, calcium hydrogen phosphate. Once you start seeing the calcium phosphate type stones in your stone analysis, you really got to think a major metabolic issue. That's usually, at least if they have it 1 or 2%, it's not a big deal, but they have a major component. That's something that we're going to talk about a little bit later. Of course, uric acid is also very important. That is the only stone that we can dissolve, you know, medically. And the other ones in the bottom, the cystine, I've never seen here because it's a congenital disease of metabolism. So usually that's somebody in the pediatric population. And now there's a difference. Certain medications can contribute to stones, but actually some medication metabolites can actually form stones. There's a pretty common medication for HIV, indinavir, that is known to form the metabolite of indinavir formed stones. The problem with that, too, is that they're the only stone that's not visualized in a CT as a calcification, as a white basic calcification. So sometimes it can cause confusion with a tumor. And triamterene, ephedrine, I just found it out when I was reviewing this information. Apparently, with the meth epidemic, ephedrine metabolites can form stones. By then, they have other much bigger problems. You have to take a lot of it to end up with a stone of ephedrine. So I know it's going to be a little bit boring, but I have to go over why do stones form, right? So, I mean, I'm going to try to touch upon that. Obviously, urine is an aqueous solution, and is water. Some inorganic materials are in elemental form, like you have your calciums floating around, your phosphates, your magnesiums, your citrate, oxalates, and proteins. Now, going back to chemistry, there is, you know, KSP, the stone for thermodynamic solubility product, meaning that if we have a water solution and we have different ions, cations, the positives, anions, the negatives, if they reach a certain concentration, they can start precipitating into salts, right? And then stones would form. Now, certain things can affect that number. One of them is temperature. The other one is pH. Obviously, in the human body, the temperature is not going to change all that much. pH does change. So the pH is the biggest contributor. We're going to really talk about temperature when we're dealing with stones because obviously we're, you know, we have a pretty stable temperature for the most part. Now, when that thermodynamic solubility product gets hit, they don't necessarily form stones in vivo because we have these nice guys called protein inhibitors. There are several protein molecules within our urine that prevents stone formation. So that will allow up to 4 to 5 times the higher concentration to be held in solution before we start forming crystals. So they're helping us for that. And so the actual formation product is much higher than the solubility product. Obviously, the most important factors for stone formation, what's the most common stone? Calcium oxalate. So it'd be calcium and oxalate. Now, of course, and we always tend to forget this, it's a concentration. So the more dilute the concentration is, the less likely it's going to form. That's why the easiest and also what I call the hardest treatment for stones is just drink more water, right? I mean, it just comes makes a lot of sense. The hard thing is because people forget to take, you know, to drink water. So we talked about that a little bit. So basically, if all the way down here we're very dilute, we're good. That means that we're never going to form stones. You have the solubility product. Here you have the metastable area that you can form a few stones. If they're crystals, they can pass. If you're physically active, they can pass, other things. So matrix is basically protein materials that, you know, the crystals can stick on and form stones. You know, heterogeneous nucleation means that you have, say, uric acid crystal, and then it piles on a calcium oxide crystals, and they grow more and more. That's why most stones are, you know, different compounds. So this is basically where it happens. Once it hits a formation product, then we have nucleation, and then we have stones. So this is an important concept to understand because that bar can move lower if we lack certain proteins. And, you know, so basically that's why, you know, a stone former might be much lower than somebody that never formed stones. So So we talked about it a little bit before. So obviously when you have increased calcium and oxalate in your urine, what does that happen? Obviously, low volume. There's inhibitors of stones. The big ones are citrate and magnesium. So if you have a lot of those guys in there, you're not going to form stones. If you have the bad guys, it's uric acid, oxalate, calcium, and phosphate, then you will form stones. And of course, if you know you never drink any water and you have a dehydrated state. Now, homogeneous means crystals attract the same crystals. You have calcium oxalate crystals, they're going to attract more calcium oxalate crystals. Heterogeneous obviously is different. It will be uric acid or protein or something else, you know, forming and piling on top of that. Matrix, reason when we talk about matrix and stones, has nothing to do with that movie from whatever, Keanu Reeves, but basically it's the protein, the organic material, almost like the scaffolding that the crystals pile up on top. And, you know, the one thing that is a bane for a lot of urologists and a lot of internists is like stents, you know, Foley catheters. I mean, that's basically something foreign that crystals love to pile on top, and that's why we like to, you know, cannot leave stents in too long, especially in stone formers. So now oxalate, a lot of people don't know this, but directly has a direct toxicity to kidneys. I mean, it's, you know, obviously because we clear it, it could be quite toxic, but in certain conditions, we'll talk about later, it can actually damage the renal cells. So when they've done electron microscopy analysis, where do stones start? Usually stones start in the papilla of the kidney. But typically, those epithelial renal cells have sustained oxalate-induced cell injury. They've done, you know, mice models and things like that. And if you can overfeed, I guess, mice with oxalate, you're going to find out that the stones tend to form where the oxalate has damaged those cells. And it has to do with, you know, free radicals and things like that. But it is something to be aware of. And, of course, the role of pH for certain types of stones. I mean, if you... you know, you have what I call the sweet spot of pH you want to keep it in, 6 to 7. If you're too low, you have a tendency to form uric acid stones either directly or calcium stones as a result of heterogeneous nucleation with uric acid. And if you're too high, that's a setup, you know, when you have a, you know, urinary tract infection. So so talk about some of the players in the game, so to speak. I'm going to try to simplify it as best I can because it does get confusing with, you know, with all the renal issues. And but basically citrate, if you're going to remember something, remember citrate. He's a really good guy. Citrate is found, of course, in diet. Citrus fruit, lemonade is big, orange juice. But it's also produced, you know, endogenously. So it does 3 great things. For starters, citrate is a negative organic anion. It will bind to calcium. So it's kind of a scavenger. So if you have calcium and citrate, we do not form calcium citrate stones, so the calcium will be you know, eliminated that way. If there's not a lot of citrate, calcium is going to find his other bad buddy, the oxalate, and is going to form crystals, and also the phosphate. So citrate is good that way. Also, it's been shown that it directly inhibits precipitation of calcium oxide crystals, and also prevents the enucleation when uric acid is involved. So it's good all the way around, and it's really not something that can be toxic as far as we know. Now, the other good guys, I mean, magnesium is important, and there's those proteins, nephrocalcin, tamsulfur, uropontin, heparin, but these are parts of the matrix when they've, you know, under electron microscopy, they've dissected stones. They're in there because they're doing their best trying to prevent, you know, enucleation and formation of stones, but of course sometimes they fail. But there's been studies across the board that these type of proteins prevent stone formation. And of course, we never forget water. I put it there because it's obvious, but we always forget it. So, so these are the good guys. So the bad guys. Now, I put calcium as a bad guy. It's really not really bad. I mean, he kind of like gets dragged along because he's also good, right? I mean, calcium is a very important ion for the functions of all the cells in our body and also for our bones. And interestingly, for lack of a better term, he always gets dragged in to deform the stones. I mean, when we inject a load of calcium, the majority of it, you know, comes out the other end. Only about 30 to 40% is of the ingested calcium is absorbed, and means the 60, whatever, 70% comes out the other end. And the key way that it gets absorbed through the intestine is vitamin D. This little pathway, I know it's confusing, but it is important because if you're going to remember one pathway, this is it. When you have a low blood calcium, right, let me see here, blood calcium, then it's going to stimulate parathyroid hormone release from the parathyroid gland. This little enzyme, 1-alpha hydroxylase, is in the kidneys that will cleave the vitamin D to the very active metabolite of vitamin D. Now we have blood, parathyroid, kidney. This is blood again, and then this thing leads to increased intestinal absorption. Okay, we're not going to absorb calcium unless we have this vitamin D metabolite. Okay, so basically this PTH molecule will enhance renal calcium absorption through this pathway and also at the kidney level and reduce absorption of phosphate. So from nephrology, as we remember, majority of calcium does get reabsorbed at the renal proximal tubule. But of course, if we have some of these factors going awry, then we might end up with more calcium in the urine. That's really what ultimately will cause stones. So I said that kind of a bad guy, this is the really bad guy, oxalate, okay? Oxalate, for the most part, gets passively absorbed, meaning that whatever oxalate we eat, we're going to absorb. Now, only about 50% of oxalate that ends up in the urine comes from diet. The other 50% comes from metabolic processes within our body that increase when we have, you know, those states of you know, obesity and all those other things. But the one key thing to remember, and that's why you should never, ever, ever recommend a low calcium diet to a stone former. Okay, I know it seems kind of antithetical, but it does make sense because when you have calcium in your gut, it will bind up oxalate, and it's going to come out the other end. Oxalate is not going to get absorbed. As we spoke earlier, calcium is very tightly regulated through a kind of processes that unless they go off, it's not going to be an issue in the urine, but oxalate will be absorbed. So, you know, in general, we want to, you know, have the oxalate with calcium and magnesium because that would decrease in absorption. So now this, some newer studies that came out, kind of like the H. pylori for GI, we found out, imagine that, there's a little bacteria in the intestine called Oxalobacter formigenes. What does that do? It breaks down oxalate in the gut. So we have less oxalate to absorb. So we can hypothesize that giving antibiotics all the time and knocking out the microbiome of the gut then could also lead to stones. So that is something that is probably happening. And pretty much, like I said earlier, whatever we absorb at the gut ends up out in the urine. So you eat a lot of oxalate, you're going to have a lot of oxalate in the urine, you're going to probably get stones. So, again, I know it's going to be confusing. All these things sound the same. Obviously, Greek, hyper, more, calcium, uric, urine. So if you have a lot of calcium in urine, hypercalciuria, that's the most common condition of, a metabolic abnormality we found in the urine of stone formers. It's defined as 200 milligrams per day of urinary calcium. Break it down in three parts. I mean, I know it sounds confusing, absorptive, excretory, resorptive. This I have to think about. Intestine, renal, bone/parathyroid hormone, okay? So that's easier for me to remember. So absorptive is obvious. We just absorb more calcium when we have calcium. That is vitamin D mediated. Always remember sarcoid, because sarcoid does make a vitamin D type molecule. In this particular case, there's always normal blood calcium. Excretory is done in the kidney level. There's something wrong with the kidneys, and they have decreased renal tubular absorption, and also normal calcemia. This is a big one, especially for the internists in the room. When somebody presents with kidney stones, even though it's not common, but it is serious, it could be hyperparathyroidism, okay? How do we know that? Blood calcium will be elevated. Not necessarily in the abnormal range, but usually above 10, okay? Now, it's not always hyperparathyroidism. In an outpatient setting, it is, but the most common reason of hypercalcemia in a hospital setting is actually malignancy, because you have this other little thing, PTH-related peptide, which is produced, from what I remember, from a lot of these type of malignant tumors, lung, so on and so forth. So that's something that, you know, you can make a good diagnosis if you find a hypercalcemic patient with kidney stones in the hospital. So, and also, which is also a big one, corticosteroids can lead, because they lead to bone resorption, can lead to hypercalciuria, because all that bone that being resorbed, all that calcium that's being resorbed from the bone has to come out one way or another, and it will come out through the kidney. So it will lead to stones. The other common condition that we find in stone formers is elevated urinary oxalates, as defined by 40 milligrams or more a day of urinary oxalate. This is just, I'm going to touch upon it. It's a horrible disease. It's basically an inborn error of metabolism. Basically cannot manage oxalates at all. Genetic disease, most of these kids don't make it past 20. These are the two things we're going to focus here. Intestinal malabsorption. This, for the GI doctors in the room, is very common. Any condition that induces chronic diarrhea, the obvious one is Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel disease, celiac sprue, but of course, iatrogenic, right? Bariatric surgery, bowel resections, all these are states of chronic diarrhea. They're going to have increased oxalates. Why does that happen? Two reasons. The obvious ones, they're dehydrated, because if you're losing a lot of fluids through your intestine, you're not going to have a concentrated urine. But the other one, just as big, if not bigger, increase oxalate ingestion. As we mentioned earlier, you need calcium to bind up the oxalate in the gut. Obviously, these patients have a short gut syndrome, and they're absorbing the oxalate too quickly. The calcium doesn't have a chance to bind up that calcium, so the oxalate gets absorbed, and they end up with a lot of kidney stones. So, and of course, the one that we always consult patients, these are the biggies. I think it's dark tea. I think green tea and white tea is okay, but any kind of dark brewed tea, doesn't matter if it's a hot or iced tea, is a big thing for stones. And chocolate, nuts, spinach. I mean, I get confused at times, so I always tell the patients, Google it online, low oxalate diet, you'll see all the things there. But tea is usually big. I've seen patients that went to a tea diet type of thing and they formed stones and never had stones before. So, so let's go. And there's also a pretty big in our patient population, high uric acid in the urine, okay? 10% of stone formers. Now, uric acid is bad in two ways. One, it can actually cause stones. I mean, at a low pH, uric acid can precipitate and form uric acid stones, but it's also through heterogeneous enucleation because can cause calcium oxalate stones. So typically, these are the patients that are prone to gout, the gouty diathesis, but also it's quite common in lymphoproliferative disease, anemia, polycythemia. There's other conditions that can cause a state of high uric acid in the blood, and that's easily checked with a uric acid level or analysis of the urine. So hypocitraturia is also, like, that's low urinary citrate, is also a common cause of stone formation, and it's always correctable. I'm going to touch upon that a little bit. Distal RTA, one of those conditions of non-GAP metabolic acidosis. It's, I always get confused, hypokalemic, hyperchloremic, right? But as far as we're concerned, it can cause other problems, but it's a patients that have distal RTA will get a lot of stones because they have a very low urinary citrate. Normal is 320 milligrams and above. Sometimes I've seen them as low as 40 or 50. So unless you collect the citrate, they will get stones, regardless what else you do with them. So now RTA, most of it is acquired. Any condition that damages the kidneys can lead to RTA, obstructive uropathy, recurrent kidney infections, ATN for whatever reason, transplantation, analgesic. When I put NSAIDs, if you take a couple of Advil, you're fine. But if you have an analgesic, full-on analgesic nephropathy, you can get RTA and stone sarcoidosis. Now, primary hyperparathyroidism doesn't cause it directly, but if you've had it for a while, you got a bunch of stones and so on and so forth, you will get RT as a result of chronic exposure to stones and such. So infection stones. Now, there is some confusion. Not everybody comes in the hospital has an infection, a stone has infection stones, okay? The majority of them actually that come in this hospital have an infection that's already there, they get an obstructing stone, and they get really sick. That doesn't actually mean it's an infection stone. The term infection stone is actually meant to describe stones that are formed by bacteria, okay? Some bacteria, the classic one is Proteus, but there's some other ones, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas, Staph aureus, make this nice little enzyme called urease. Urease takes uric acid and in the milieu of calcium and other things, electrolytes in the urine, make this very long, you know, crystal and calcium phosphate, called triple phosphate. But basically, it's more common in women, obviously, because urinary tract infections are more common in women. That makes sense. Most staghorn stones, for the non-urologists in the room, staghorn stones are huge stones, are infection stones, but not all of them. The reason is they get to be so big, obviously, they don't start filling up the whole kidneys because many times they become, you know, undiagnosed. Somebody gets a UTI, they get an antibiotic, go home, come back, go home. Now, the one thing to remember, if you see a UTI, you should always image the patient, and because they could have a stone that may not be a staghorn yet, but it could be related to that infection. But of course, if you leave it long enough, it will become staghorn. One thing that we need to remember, E. coli, the most common pathogen for you know, urinary tract infections, does not produce urease. So that's okay, but all these other things plus other ones do. So the obvious patients that get these stones are the ones that are more obviously going to get urinary tract infections. Your diabetics, spinal cord injury, urinary diversions, things that have risks for urinary tract infections. So these are just a grab bag category. We only see I've only seen one, but you'll know ammonium acid urate. This is anorexics, laxative abuse. They have a extreme state of dehydration. That's what can happen to inflammatory bowel disease. But basically, when you have a lot of dehydration, ammonium binds up uric acid and forms this type of stone. So if you see the stone, you better get a workup for some type of severe inflammatory bowel disease. Matrix stones, occasionally, rarely, the protein residue in the urine can form stones. It can get confused as tumors because, of course, there's no calcification there. And we talked about these other stones. The one thing to watch out here, corticosteroids, these medications indirectly contribute to stones. They're not form stones through the metabolites as these three, but the corticosteroids that we talked about before through the bone loss pathway, increased stone formations. Vitamin D, obviously, in some patients can increase absorption through the gut of calcium. Antacids, will bind up calcium. The calcium will bind up in some people that have absorptive hypercalciuria will increase urinary calcium, and Topamax, which is commonly used neurology drug, can increase calcium in the urine and decrease citrate. So that's something that you need to be aware of if you put on Topamax, especially the neurologist in the room, I think is fairly commonly used. So now we're getting to the metabolic evaluation of stones. It's been an hour already? No, sorry. No, it's half an hour. Okay, good. We're on track. Metabolic stone evaluation. Just want to make sure we're on time. Who do we evaluate? Obviously, only 50%, 40 to 50% of patients that have a stone will get another stone in 10 years. So that means I tell a lot of my patients, of course, they're referred to me after they pass a stone. Everybody's terrified and say, I don't want to go through this again. Do I need an evaluation? I'm like, oh, you can flip a coin, right? I mean, there's a chance that you might not. It's about 50% chance over the next 10 years. So if they're elderly, in their 60s, they never had a stone, it was a pretty small stone, I'll tell them, hydrate, fall on low oxalate diet, and, good luck. You're probably not going to get it. But these other patient populations we need to evaluate. Obviously, children. I mean, we have to worry about metabolic disorders, strong family history. Recurrent, these are not first-time formers. Intestinal disease, anytime we see, I mentioned the anorexics, chronic diarrheal states, they need to be worked up. If we're seeing in conjunction with osteoporosis and fractures, we've got a light has to go above our head of, basically this could be a parathyroid patient, and also if they have chronic steroid use. Recurrent UTI, because obviously we'd be dealing with an infection stone, and other anatomic abnormalities, transplant, solitary kidney, and of course the kidney's already being affected. So this is what we do. This is the most basic as it gets. Like every patient that we see, we have to take a history, focusing on the medication and supplements. This is all you need as far as your blood work. And I would even say if your calcium is normal, under 10, you don't need to do this PTH, you know. But obviously, if your calcium is a little bit high, you need to do the PTH. I always like to do uric acid because, again, it can contribute to stone formation. Your analysis is also extremely important. One, if you get these pHs, you already have your diagnosis. Rarely you see a pH more than 7.5, and if you do, especially in the setting of an infection, you got your diagnosis. That's a urea-splitting organism. That's an infection stone. If an extremely low pH, it's a uric acid predisposition. So, and sometimes in the urinalysis, you can see things like crystals, of course, hematuria, which is a sign of somebody passing a stone. And very, very important, always do a culture, especially in the inpatient setting. You know, patients coming from the ER, because pretty much every patient with a stone that comes to the ER, they're there for a reason. Why? Because they're having a lot of pain. Now, they don't come there and say, I have an infection. They come in and say, I'm having horrible pain. So it's up to the ER physicians and the residents and everybody else to determine, is this a patient I can send home, or is this a patient that needs to be admitted and treated? And a culture is a key part. Now, pretty much everybody that's passing a stone is going to have a fever, you know, because the kidney's a pretty big organ, and it's going to cause a reactive, fever from the obstruction. Now, there's a fine line between a fever due to sterile obstruction, of course, you know, an obstructive pyelonephritis, and, you know, the culture will tell us later on if somebody needs to be treated and how to be treated. As we know, there's a lot of antibiotic resistance, so you cannot just, you know, send people on Cipro or Levaquin or Macrobid anymore. You really need to do a culture and find out what the organism is, especially somebody who's been treated before. These are the three main state x-rays that we do. Historically, KUB, plain abdominal x-ray, misses about 20 to 30% of stones, but it's still used, especially in follow-up. Renal ultrasound is very useful, shows hydronephrosis and other changes of stone. But the standard study is non-contrast CT scan. It's readily available. It can, diagnose other pathology, diverticulitis, appendicitis, even ruptured abdominal aneurysm can cause similar symptoms as a stone. So when a patient comes in and is complaining of horrific back and abdominal pain and nausea and vomiting, that's a quick and easy study to know which way to go. And of course, once they pass a stone, try to analyze a stone, because there's certain types that you already have your diagnosis. If you get a cystine stone or a uric acid stone, you already know what you have. But on an outpatient setting, this is the mainstay of evaluation, a 24-hour urine stone panel. Now, there's a couple commercial kits available. It's become a lot easier. People don't have to walk around, drive around Boca with jugs. I've never seen a jug in my office for years. They're outpatient-based. People are sent home, to their house a kit, and they collect the urine and they send back to the company. We'll get a nice report, I'll show you later, of all these things. We're looking at volume, calcium, oxalate, citrate, sodium, phosphate, magnesium, potassium, pH, uric acid, and sulfate. They're all pretty obvious while we check them. The sulfate is a tracker of animal protein ingestion. Protein is a big contributor to kidney stone formation, so if somebody has a lot of urinary sulfate, that's somebody you need to tell them, you know, cut back on your protein ingestion. This is what a non-contrast CT shows. This happens to be a uric acid stone. The reason I know that is because I know that, you know, I removed it. But basically, has to do with the Hounsfield units. They used to get kind of fancy, the radiologists, and tell us, oh, that's a calcium oxalate stone, a uric acid stone. It does help to a degree, but I think they kind of stopped doing that. This guy may have a little tumor there. I don't know about that. But basically, another thing this guy doesn't have, because really not an obstructing stone, it's in the renal pelvis. But occasionally, the radiologist, again, you know, I stress the residents here, be a doctor. One of my pet peeves, and it's happened the last couple of years, somebody gets admitted to the ER, they do a CT, there's some stranding around the kidney, and the radiologist says, well, you know, there's stranding around the kidney, patient's infected, this is pyelonephritis. I'm a urologist, there's a couple other urologists in the room, I've never been able to diagnose pyelonephritis on a CT scan. I can tell you what, I mean, unless, of course, you have an abscess kidney, I can tell you what, pretty much every patient with an obstructing ureteral stone will have some stranding around the kidney. Doesn't mean it's pyelonephritis. Why do they do that? Because, as you can imagine, the kidney gets swollen, and some of the urine inflammation will leak through the capsule of the kidney. The kidney doesn't burst, obviously, so there's going to be other ways the urine needs to drain. If it doesn't drain the normal way down the ureter, so somebody's going to be swelling, you know. So, again, you know, of course, sometimes there is an infection involved, and that's why I'm asking you to look at the whole picture. You know, your CBC, bacteria in the urine, all the things that we know, you know, through the culture. So this is a ureteral stone right there. So always have to kind of follow the ureter all the way down. Sometimes when it gets down to the pelvis, there is some confusion with flebulus and other things. And, you know, CT scan is really good, but it's not perfect. It's about 90, 95% accurate. Occasionally, you know, you can have somebody's got a small stone that's not readily visible. So we need to have the level of suspicion high, but it is pretty good. So this is a patient, give you this is a report you get from the stone analysis. Now, calcium oxalate, like I said earlier, rarely they're 100% one thing. They're usually a combination of a few things. This particular lady, I've been seeing her for years. She's got this carbonate appetite. When you see that, you know, you got a worse, you got a metabolic predisposition. If you see mainly calcium oxalate, it could be a one-off. But it's rarely, if you see this other components, that it's a one-off. It could be a metabolic predisposition. This lady's had a bunch of these stone risk analysis. And the thing that jumps out, you know, and the reason I'm bringing her up is because she's in my office literally every 6 months to a year because it's not very compliant. As you can see, going back, look at the, where's the citrate? It's right there. Okay, so when she first diagnosed a while back, citrate has to be at least 315, I think that was done after. She's already been seen for a while. Then she did not become compliant and then dropped down to 259. Normal should be about 350. And then she did really well right there. She's taking a lot of potassium citrate. Then she fell off again. She went all the way down to 40. I mean, so, you know, it is important to kind of follow up these patients, make sure that, you know, they're being treated. And we'll talk about the medical management next. So I know it gets confusing, but there's about 12 different, you know, when you go to the stone clinic and you break down categories, there's about 12 categories, right? The first six has to do with calcium, right? So one thing you need to remember, it's all about the calcium, right? The other stuff is kind of like I said, the minor categories, but all these things, I think it's actually seven. You know, magnesium is also calcium. The first seven out of the 12 have to do with calcium. So saying patients' forms of calcium stone is not enough. We've got to categorize them to all these things. Absorbed, like I said, intestine, renal, kidney, primary hyperthyroidism, obviously, sometimes unclassified. These are the people that have too much oxalates in the urine, your primary enteric dietary. This is low urinary citrate, like the lady we just showed. Magnesium, so you're right, it's not even six, it's seven that have involved. So the first seven categories involve calcium-type stones, calcium oxalate, calcium phosphate, and then you have, what I said, the rest, right? Uric acid, that's the most common of the quote-unquote the rest. Like I said, 10% of stones are pure uric acid stones, cystinurics, rare, infection stones, low urinary volume is a category, believe it or not, and then you have the rest, right, the medication stones and so on and so forth. So how do we medically manage these patients, okay? I put this first because that's for everyone, right? Fluids. You got to drink fluids because everybody will tell you, well, I drink enough. I'm like, really? You know, most stone patients, especially here, they don't drink enough. You have to drink more. You have to produce more than 2 liters of urine a day. That means you have to drink at least 3 liters a day. Anybody's done that? That's a lot of water to drink. It doesn't have to be water. It could be any kind of fluid. What I tell them, honestly, so I'm like, oh, how much is that? How many glasses? I'm like, I don't want to get into the whole idea because your glass and all this. But basically what I tell them, and I don't know if you're out in the golf course all day or what do you do, but basically when you urinate, it's got to look like water. I mean, I know it's very tough to do because if you're urinating, it looks very concentrated. That means you're not drinking enough. That's your light going off saying, okay, I got to drink some more. That's what I usually tell them. It's usually a pretty good goal to aspire. As far as the different types of water, carbonated water, the clear one, the one that has citrate flavor, that's just kind of like your 7-Ups, your Frescas, all that is good. The phosphoric acid that's used to preserve in a lot of sodas is bad. Your Cokes, your Diet Pepsis, that increases risk. And actually, this is something that I learned from a patient of mine to care for stones, also a dentist. That's a bad one for enamel in the teeth too, because this phosphoric acid, which is, I guess, prevalent as a preservative in a lot of things, guess what it does? It leaches out calcium out of the bone, also from the enamel. So sodas are not just bad for, I guess that she told me that. I mean, I learned that from her. Not just bad because they have sugar, but even diet sodas are bad because they have this thing that can also leach calcium out of your teeth and your bones. And of course, if you're leaching out of your bones, it's going to end up in your urine. Water hardness, there's been some studies, probably inconsequential. The citrus juice, we always tell patients, drink lemonade. The problem with lemonade, of course, to flavor it with sugar, it's a lot of sugar, but Lemon juice is better than orange juice, has more citrate, but it is good to introduce that. And I said 3 liters a day. Things in the medical management, this pretty much goes across the board for every patient we see with stones. Limit protein, especially from animal protein, because high protein ingestions leads to increased urinary calcium, increased oxalate, and uric acid, okay? And also, sodium carries calcium into the urine. So, and that's always a good thing to recommend to patients in general, you know, try to lose some weight, don't eat that much salt, because salt is also big in hypertension, but also sodium. If we take too much sodium, there's a sodium-calcium co-transporter in the kidney that, as we releasing, sodium, you know, also releasing calcium. So, and we end up with, you know, calcium salts in the urine. So, and of course, if we see a woman with osteoporosis, we have to be aware of that too. And obviously, you know, she needs to be advised to take care of that. So, obesity, obvious. Tell people to lose weight. That's another reason to lose weight, not that we didn't have enough, but certainly obesity does cause kidney stones, and especially in women, they need to lose weight. The problem is that a lot of the kind of trendy, low-carb, high-protein diets also increase stone risk because there's a lot of protein. So I would always recommend, I mean, I think it's a laudable cause for people to lose weight, but if they get into these, you know, paleo, Atkins type of diets, also include a lot of vegetables. The good healthy vegetables that will bring in the magnesium, the citrate, to counteract the effect of high protein, because actually these diets also lead to bone loss too. They can get fractures. So, and of course, bariatric surgery itself, part of the diarrheal states, intestinal disease, really obese people have bariatric surgery. They're at risk of stones. I mean, I think it's quite common within 6 months to a year after bariatric surgery, patients will end up in the urologist or the ER, the urologist's office with a stone. Never had stones before. So, again, general recommendations. Big thing, everybody remember, do not recommend low calcium ingestion. I mean, the whole thing, cut back on dairy and all stuff, it's all, you know, been debunked, right? So, we recommend moderate calcium ingestion, not, of course, too high, because that's not good either, but definitely not low. The low calcium ingestion, leads to stone formation via the oxalate pathways. So I'm just putting something here. So, and that's the reason we recommend moderate calcium intake. When we do calcium supplementation, because of course a lot of women, especially that are at risk of osteoporosis, ask me, so can I take calcium? I'm like, absolutely. If you're going to take calcium, stick with this thing, calcium citrate. You get the best of both worlds. They get the calcium for their bones. They get some nice citrate for the, you know, for the kidneys and prevent kidney stones. So that's a good form of calcium supplementation. Women that ask for that, vitamin D is controversial. In some patients, if you take an excessive amount of vitamin D to the intestinal pathway, it can lead to more stones. So, of course, recurrent stone formers. If you're going to put them in vitamin D, it's probably a good idea to do a follow-up 24-hour urinary calcium to see if it's affecting them. So, and of course, recommend that to everybody. Low oxalate diet, I mean, there's really no harm done in anyone with low oxalate. Calcium, it does get a little tricky, but low oxalate, I recommend everyone with a stone. It's good all around, especially the enteric causes. I mean, people with Crohn's disease, celiac sprue, they should all be in low oxalate diet. Vitamin C, that's something that it's a maybe. Vitamin C is a substrate to oxalate. It gets converted. They should not overdo it. I mean, 2 grams a day, not more than that. So, breaking down to the individual categories, the thiazides are big in the management of the intestinal, I guess that's the absorptive, and the renal. It's ideal for renal, you know, urinary calcium. Now, what thiazides do, other than, of course, being a great, you know, the original blood pressure pills, they induce a state of diuresis. By the way, they do that. They work in the distal renal tubule, and calcium is being reabsorbed. So you end up with less calcium in your urine, and of course, you know, less chance to form stones. Now, they have some nasty side effects. While doing that, they also end up with low urinary citrate. So in general, if you're treating the stone patient with thiazides, it's always a good idea to supplement potassium citrate, because you're fixing one problem causing something else. You're fixing their high urinary calcium, but you're also causing a high urinary citrate. So it's always a good idea to supplement with that. And watch out, of course, for side effects. Potassium wasting, cramps, high uric acid. So it also can lead to high uric acid in the urine. So the third one, and this is something you have to be aware, if you give thiazide to somebody who's got primary hyperparathyroidism, you know what's going to happen? They're going to get a cardiac arrhythmia. Their blood calcium is already elevated. You give them a thiazide, it gets more elevated. So that's the word of caution here. The first two, all day long, you can give them thiazide diuretics. But if they already had an elevated blood calcium and you're thinking hyperparathyroidism, you got to rule that out. Actually, it's actually a diagnostic test. I don't know how often it's used. The endocrinologist would know. A diagnostic test for primary hyperthyroidism, do the thiazide challenge. You give somebody thiazide, if next day they got calcium through the roof, that's your diagnosis. But I would recommend, I guess, to check a parathyroid hormone first. And of course, the only treatment is surgical removal of the thyroid, parathyroid glands. So when we're talking about, these are calcium oxalate stones that are due to a high uric acid state, not uric acid stones, but the treatment is basically the same. Whether you have actually high, uric acid in the urine, of course, uric acid comes from animal protein, so recommend restriction of dietary protein. Allopurinol is a great, it's a oldie but goodie kind of drug. I just heard a personal story recently that it did work very well for somebody in this room. But basically, the recommendation is anywhere from 150 to 300 milligrams a day. Blocks. Now, it's not a good drug to treat an active uric acid stone, but it's good to prevent something down the road. And, of course, it's a good drug for gout, too, because it just decreases, uric acid in the blood, of course, in the urine through this conversion. When it comes to the urinary tract, because, remember, going way back to the chemistry of the stones, uric acid precipitates in a acidic pH. If we rise the pH above 6.0 but not over 7, we can actually dissolve uric acid crystals in the urine. It's the only stone that, if somebody's very patient, you can actually dissolve without having to do surgery. So people kind of like that sometimes. Of course, they have to be very compliant with the pH because, of course, they always forget taking the potassium citrate. And, of course, different people require different doses, and you have to basically titrate to the effect. Another little trick I found out for a patient, like, oh, how do I know, doc, on a day-to-day basis, I'm between 6 and 7? And actually a patient told me that. Go to your favorite pool store because you're not going to get, dipsticks because they're expensive and it's rarely available for everyone. But pool stores, to check your water in your pool do have pH strips. So for lack of a better term, pee on your pH strip from the pool and figure out 6 to 7. That's where you want it on. And then, of course, if you go over 7, take a little bit less potassium citrate. If you under 6, you take a little bit more. So this is the diarrheal states. Of course, forced fluid intake. I mean, these are patients that lose a lot of fluid through their bowel loss, and recommend, actually, everybody on Crohn's disease, especially ones that have stones, they should be getting calcium supplementation up to a gram a day because that binds the oxalate in the gut very quickly so they don't absorb the oxalate. And they really have a hard time absorbing solid potassium citrate, so we look at liquid forms, calcium citrate. And again, this is new stuff with the probiotics. I think probiotics is a new hot thing about everything. We should consider this for this too. Low urinary citrate and RTA, obviously you have to supplement with potassium citrate. Avoid, and we talked about because thiazide is used very commonly for absorptive and renal hypercalciuria. So add potassium citrate because you will get that secondary complication. Do have a lot of GI upsets sometimes, potassium citrate, because that citric acid is irritative to the stomach and duodenum. The others, obviously, low magnesium in the urine. You really can't push the magnesium. It causes intestinal side effects. Gouty diathesis, same as the uric acid. We treat with pH and allopurinol. And cystinurics, that's specialized case. There's this drug, Theola. And, of course, anorexia, you got to fix that. Infection stones, these are the struvite stones. The key thing, this is for surgery. Never, never take somebody to the OR unless you have to with an untreated infection. You're not going to remove big infection stones. Somebody has not been on antibiotics because they're at very high risk of sepsis and coagulopathy. So typically, we try to do cultures. Even if we do cultures and we put them the right antibiotics, they're still at risk because there's a lot of bacteria within the stone matrix itself, and they can get released during the procedure. So all the urologists in the room know that these are high-risk patients. There is, for the non-operative candidates, this drug called lithostat that basically blocks that urease enzyme, and it does work, but it does have significant side effects. The most significant is DVT, about 15% of the patients, so you got to be careful if you use that. And now that everybody knows how to treat stones, we're going to talk all about surgery. So basically, like this lady, everybody's an expert that comes to our office. Now we're going to get the urology consult. As you probably already know, my name, I'm Greek, so who can read Greek? Right here. Ούτε με ούτε ούτε μην λυθιόντας, εκχωρίσω δεργάτη συνανδράση πράξεις τίδε. That's from the Hippocratic Oath. You know what that is? That's a urology consult. That's the original. So we're like the oldest specialty, at least that I know, of 2,500 years old. He said, I'm not going to operate on anyone, especially somebody has a stone, but I'm going to let the professionals that know how to do these things do the operation, basically. I mean, so basically, he's asking for a urology consult. That's what he's doing. It's part of the Hippocratic Oath. If you can check it if you want. So you got a urology consult. Even Hippocrates knew. So it's quite common. That's what he said, that 10% of the screen population can have asymptomatic renal. So it's the 1 out of 10 people. So it does come up. And actually, he was right. Today, we don't use a scalpel pretty much on everybody. So, you know, full circle, these procedures, they're invasive, some of them, but, you know, we don't do open kidney stone surgery anymore. So, shockwave lithotripsy, ureteroscopy, percutaneous nephrolithotomy, and rarely laparoscopic surgery. So, of course, we touched upon the history and physical before. Before we take somebody to surgery, you know, most of it is outpatient elective surgery, but there's certain cases, especially with infections, that it does become an emergency. And again, I want to stress it enough because I know we have residents in the room and ER professionals, is that gram-negative sepsis is gram-negative sepsis. When you hear somebody that said, oh, I heard somebody died of a kidney stone, I can pretty much guarantee they died because of sepsis, undertreated or lately treated sepsis. And you know, because you have a combination of a sick patient with an obstructing stone and obstructive pyelonephritis, that's a recipe of disaster, especially many times with a resistant organism. I cannot stress doing the culture underline because it's important. I mean, I've done hundreds of stones in this hospital. I've seen all kinds of crazy things grow out of culture. I've seen MRSA. I've seen yeast. I've seen, what was the other one? I've even seen CRE. You know, basically, I don't know if you guys know what CRE is, but basically Klebsiella that is not treated by any antibiotic known to man. So, and they all came with obstructing stone patients that came through the ER. So culture is key because these are the patients, if you give them your usual Cipro or Levoquin, I guess we don't use that anymore, it's important to know. Imaging, we talked about CT stone study. Pet peeve of mine, some radiologists here and urologists called a urogram, where I trained, a urogram indicated the use of contrast. So I still don't call it a urogram, I call it a CT stone study. Hopefully that's changing. But basically, it's a CT of the abdomen and pelvis without intravenous oral contrast. It's very easy to obtain. Renal ultrasound in some cases if it's not readily available. So, and of course, it can lead to the diagnosis of other pathologies that can present that way. And of course, a typical pre-op evaluation. So the decision to operate or not to operate, the majority of stones wouldn't need to operate. I mean, 80, 90% of stones coming to the ER, they'll pass the stones. Any stone that's less than 5 millimeters usually will pass. Number of stones, of course, location sometimes, if in a difficult position, composition. But of course, you have some of these issues more likely to operate. Hydronephrosis nephrosis in itself is not an indication to operate. I mean, you know, we get a consult and say, well, you know, this hydronephrosis, you got to take the surgery. Not necessarily. I mean, of course, you're going to get hydronephrosis because the kidney's obstructed. And in some ways, that's how you're going to pass a stone. You need to build up that pressure. You got to look more about this infection. An infection, of course, you need to operate anytime, temporize with a stent and operate later. You know, you got to consider the choice of your surgery. Somebody's coagulopathic, of course, pregnant, solitary kidney, elderly. And it's a recommendation by the AUA, that's American Urologic. All struvite stones, these are infection stones, need to be removed because they're going to get chronic infections and damage of the kidney over a long period of time. So thankfully, we don't see a lot of that in this community because people get scanned all the time, all kinds of things. You know, they get ultrasounds, get CT. So it's rare we're going to see a huge stone that's infection, you know. So, but it is something we need to know. This didn't come out very well, this picture. This shockwave lithotripsy. A lot of people still ask about the bathtub. That was the original lithotripsy going back 35 years ago, I guess, maybe even 40, now that it first came out. And it was a pain. I mean, obviously, you can imagine the logistics of, placing a patient on a harness in a bathtub while they're anesthetized, then cleaning the water afterwards. So anyway, you do need a water interface for the lithotripter to work. When you see that little gel pad there, we don't need to put the whole patient underwater. We can create this gel pad, contact with the flank, and there's your water interface, and the rest patient is outside of the water. So in order to target the stones, there's a C-arm involved, and to target it, of course, you know, we need that. So basically, outpatient procedure, patients like them because we can avoid a stent. It can be done for stones up to 2 centimeters, so good sizable stones. Now, there's some considerations. Somebody's more than 300 pounds, that might not be your first choice. Stone composition, if you know from your KUB or from previous experience it's a dense stone, we should probably avoid using that. And a favorable lower pole anatomy. If you break it up in the lower pole, it's got to clear. If you have a very acute angle, it might not come out. So these are two basic absolute contraindications. Never, never, ever do a lithotripsy on a pregnant woman. It can damage the fetus. And of course, uncorrected coagulopathy, because we are beating up on the kidney. Untreated UTI, and obviously, if you have another stone further down, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense to break up a kidney stone with another stone in the ureter. It's a relative contraindication. You can treat patients with arterial aneurysm, but not the ones near the stone. If you have a renal artery aneurysm, do that stone, it's probably not a good idea to do that. So, and one thing that patients don't like it here, the lithotripter in this hospital comes in, I think, 2 to 3 times a month, and they don't like that. The passing stone is not always readily available. They'll have to wait a week or so. And for that reason, this is how it works. You know, F2 point is where the stone is. Fluoroscopy. There's some side effects, right? I mean, I know pretty much 80 to 90% of patients that I treat with lithotripsy will have blood in the urine. So if that blood in the urine, that means it's doing something, right? So there is a degree of reversible acute renal injury. And there's a rare possibility of basically blowing up the kidney. It can happen. That's why you have to avoid the coagulopathic patients. It's kind of like my pet peeve. I don't want my patients to be on, you know, NSAIDs for at least 2 to 3 days prior to the lithotripsy, because the way I look at it, if something bad is going to happen, it may happen to those patients, and, you know, you want to avoid that. And for the same reason, I never, you know, it's very conservative, I never treat bilaterally. Some urologists, you have stones on both sides. If you're already here, let's treat bilaterally. My idea is that if something systemic, and it's bad enough if you blow up one kidney, it's really bad if you blow up both at the same time. So I don't do that. So arrhythmias can happen as a result of the shocks, and you have some cases that need to be monitored. And chronic renal injury, you have to worry about if they have several of these lithotripsies. So there's some techniques, of course, to prevent the side effects. This is very commonly used in a hospital setting. I know it's pretty blurry too. This is the rigid ureteroscope. It's basically, as you see, a very thin scope. The flexible, I don't have a picture of that, but the flexible is basically a mini colonoscope, basically same handpiece, but a very thin and long, flexible component. And the technology has improved, so we use it pretty much in a lot of cases. Outpatient procedure, it is readily available in the hospital and surgery center. It's become really the primary therapy for distal stones and even stones that, you know, lithotripsy doesn't work, because now with the flexible techniques, we can make it all the way up to the kidney. So this is the greatest thing invented for stones, the YAG, holmium YAG laser. Pretty much breaks up every stone. I rarely use baskets anymore because there's a risk of entrapment of, you know, fragment and ureter and complications. I mean, I know I used to use them, but there's, you know, sometimes it's a lot easier just to kind of, you know, pulverize and fragment the stone in tiny little pieces that will pass. Unfortunately, a lot of patients don't like this part. Almost always have to leave a stent after the procedure for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, as thin as that scope is, when we go up in there, it can cause some edema. So if you think they had pain before the stone, if you don't leave a stent, they're going to have a lot of pain, more pain worse. Another reason, dude, I'm going to touch upon later, even though they come into the emergency room with a clear urine, or what you think is a clear urine, a lot of the stones, they're not just the infection stones, a lot of the stones, they do have bacteria on them. There's been studies that have shown that a third of patients that had a sterile urine coming into your office or the ER, on a subsequent urine will have bacteria in your urine. So my gut feeling is if they do end up infected, it's always good to have drainage, because, you know, if you've done a procedure and they don't drain, they get an infection, that's a recipe for disaster. So I always like to leave a stent, and the patients can, you know, so basically that's what it looks like. It's magnified, that's a stone. That's a laser fiber, and just kind of, you know, breaks it up. This is the ureteral lumen. So as you can see, it's very precise. Of course, as easily as this thing can break up the stone, can easily put a hole through the ureter. So, but the nice thing, there's no dispersal of the laser energy, and it works very, very well, you know, for treatment of stones. And comes you know, laser fiber comes in different sizes for individual cases. So this is much more invasive. We don't do it that frequently, but it does work very well for those big staghorn stones. Basically, we provide access through the flank. The interventional radiologist colleagues help us with the access. Basically, it's a nephrostomy tube that we dilate, and we put rigid scopes and flexible scopes into the kidney, and remove stones. They definitely have to be off aspirin and antiplatelet drugs for at least 7 days, because obviously the risk of bleeding is significant going through the kidney. It's a very vascular organ, and there's a risk of sepsis as well because of untreated UTI or obviously staghorn stones, you know. So that's what I talked about earlier. A third of patients with a stent, and of course, you know, in this particular location that we practice, they always blame the doctor that, you know, basically spat on the stent, you know, the scope before I used it, or the sterilization equipment of the hospital. But, you know, a third of the patient will end up with a positive urine. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be infected, but their urine culture will be positive. But if you take out the stent too soon, they could be infected. So these are rarely used. Laparoscopic and robotic techniques, if there's other, usually I'd say for UPJ obstruction, you're repairing the UPJ and then, you know, you have to take out a stone. I'm going to touch upon, you know, I think we're almost done here. Basically for pregnant women, it's a catch-22. They do get more stones because they have increase of the renal blood flow, and but that gets mitigated by increased urinary citrate. The pregnant women, this is the protocol. Renal colic, check for UTI, always check for UTI, because a UTI in a pregnant woman can complicate the pregnancy. Of course, avoid x-ray, KUB, and especially CT, especially the first trimester. Ultrasonography standard, that can get confusing, because 90% of women in the third trimester will have hydronephrosis, physiologic hydronephrosis of pregnancy, especially in the right kidney. An MRI urogram is also a good value, and especially they do it here. So most of them will pass spontaneously. We used to do this, stents and percutaneous nephrostomies. That was a pain, especially in the pregnancy, because of their hypercalciuric state. Almost always had to be changed unless they were done really late. Encrustation now, we can use ureteroscopy, and by being very, very careful with fluoroscopy and shielding the fetus, we can actually get most stones out. But of course, that's reserved in severe situations. So this is some of the references. And I know we went over a little bit. If you have any questions for what I went through, I know it's a lot of information, and I hope what you take out of this, you know, at least you can recognize some of those, you know, situations that we went over. So. Okay.